Do you like animals? Sea animals? What about dolphins? Did you know that sound travels 4 times faster in water than on land? Dolphins do, because although they have eyes, they rely primarily on echolocation to navigate. Learn more about dolphin sonar systems in Illustra Media's new documentary, Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. This Friday, February 5th, Living Waters premieres in the greater Houston area. The event, to be held at Faith Bible Church in The Woodlands, Texas, will feature a special welcome by Lee Strobel, author of The Case for a Creator. The screening will be followed by a question and answer session with one of the film's featured scholars, philosopher of biology Paul Nelson. That's Friday, February 5th. Although the premiere is free, registration is required, so for more information, visit discovery.org to register. That's www.discovery.org.
Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Today we have on the show with us Dr. Tim Standish. Tim Standish earned his PhD in Environmental Science and Public Policy from George Mason University. He's a senior scientist at the Geosciences Research Institute and an adjunct faculty member at Loma Linda University. And Dr. Standish was featured in the recent film from Illustra Media, Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. And he was there talking about various topics, including salmon olfactory sensory equipment and other topics. So we wanted to have Dr. Standish on the show with us today to talk about the film Living Waters and to also talk about his personal involvement and interest in the topic of intelligent design. So Dr. Standish, thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So Dr. Standish, before we go too far into this, I'd like to hear a little bit about your work here at Loma Linda University. What do you teach and what do you do here? And what is your background?
Well, I teach molecular genetics, actually. Currently, the department I work under is in the medical school. However, I don't teach medical students. That would be dangerous. I teach graduate students molecular genetics.
Great. And how did you get involved in the film Living Waters? How did they get in touch with you? And what was your involvement in the film?
Well, I've actually known the producer, Ladd Allen, for some years. I'd done some work on earlier films, particularly Metamorphosis and Flight, and they wrote me into this as well. In addition to that, the master's degree that I did had to do with a marine organism, so that sort of pulled me in a bit. Who isn't in love with the oceans anyway? And as we started to discuss some of the topics, it seemed like I was being sucked into the vortex. Let's put it that way. I have no regrets about it.
Yeah, Lester puts out fantastic films. I'm sure it's long overdue, actually, that we have you on the podcast because you've been working with them for a while. So can you tell us just a little bit about what you talked about in Living Waters and maybe what topics from that film interested you?
Well, there are a number of things that we talked about, but probably the thing that I found most mesmerizing myself was the salmon olfaction system. This is the system of smell, basically, that salmon have as they negotiate back to the natal stream, the stream where they were born, well, where they hatched from an egg. And the fact that they are queuing in on just a very few molecules, it looks like it's primarily amino acids. And you can think about those amino acids as acting something like a barcode. For us, it's not that they are smelling every possible odor in the water they're swimming through. They're queuing in on just a few of them, and they're looking for exactly the right ratios, and somehow or other they're able to do that. It's unimaginable to me as a human being, even though I personally have a very large nose and I'm good at smelling myself.
Well, as someone who has terrible allergies and really can't smell anything, I was amazed by what those salmon can do. And if I recall correctly, Dr. Standish, it's not just finding that particular stream or that little beachhead where they were born. It's the whole pathway to get there. They're able to navigate everything along the way. So I guess they're just remembering this. It's imprinted on this when they're born and when they migrate out. Is that essentially what's going on?
Well, it looks like that's exactly it. They seem to memorize things all the way down the river to the river mouth. It's not just the smell of the water that they're going after, though. They also have a magnetic system that they're using. And it looks like their ability to detect the magnetic field of the Earth in certain places is used in combination on a large scale. When they're out there swimming out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, they're probably using the magnetic system. But once they get into the river, where they're doing very fine scale navigation and they're having to test every little tributary that they go past, that's when the olfaction really kicks in a big way.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So, Dr. Stanish, I know that you've been involved with the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design for many years. You've done a lot of writing and speaking and teaching on this topic. I'd just love to know a little bit about your own personal background. What personally got you interested in the topic of origins, and how long have you been studying this topic?
I love this stuff. I'm very interested in philosophy as well as biology, obviously, and the sciences. I grew up in a very multicultural environment. It was in a Muslim country, but there was a large Buddhist, Taoist minority there, as well as a large Hindu minority, specifically where we live. So I was interested in the differences between different belief systems and how they looked at the world in different ways. Then obviously studying in a secular environment exposed me to other kinds of ideas. Frankly, I myself had my personal faith challenged on occasion. It's caused me to reevaluate, why am I interpreting things in the way that I do that? So there's not one thing really, but certainly I found the idea of intelligent design, the open-mindedness of it, to be a very attractive thing. The struggle that people have gone through to actually answer what seems like a very obvious question. I mean, how do you tell whether something's designed or not? We do it all the time, and yet the details of that, we really don't think through very hard. So I appreciate that there are people out there who are thinking about this very, very carefully, and I want to know more about it myself.
Well, you're one of those people, Dr. Stanish. If you don't mind me putting you on the spot here then, what would you say is your favorite argument for intelligent design? I know you deal with many different aspects of this debate in your work and your writing, but for you personally, what really strikes you as one of the strongest arguments for intelligent design?
Well, can I really narrow it down to only one? I'm going to give you two, and I'm going to be very brief about it. The first is beauty. I mean, nature is so gratuitously beautiful, and it's a terrible thing for somebody to have lost the ability to see that and appreciate it, both at an intellectual level, but also at a visceral level. There's something fantastic about it. There's something built into us that it responds in a profound emotional way to beautiful things, and there's lots of those around. If we don't basically shut our minds and our eyes to that. The second thing that has me very interested are these large, complex ecological relationships that we see out there. Now, that's not something that we really talk about a huge amount when we're talking about intelligent design. But the example that I personally like the best is the nitrogen cycle. Here we have this gigantic global cycle. It is absolutely essential for life to exist on Earth, and it's spread across multiple organisms. And all of those basic functions that we see in the nitrogen cycle have to work, or, well, conceiving of a world in which they don't work and life exists is rather difficult, let's put it that way. So I'm amazed by it. It's something that had to have come into existence relatively fast, because if it didn't come into existence relatively fast, we would not have the fabulous nitrogen-rich atmosphere that we have, and yet nitrogen also readily available to living things for use in amino acids and nucleic acids. So without the nitrogen cycle, no proteins and no DNA.
Wow. This is one of these areas that I see more and more ID theorists talking about, sort of the design of ecology and looking at the design, not just of living organisms for the environment, but the design of the environment for living organisms and the way that the chemistry of all this works together to make a really elegant system that's fit for life. I like where this is going. I think ID needs to break into these arguments more and more. But the nitrogen cycle, I mean, we're talking about different types of organisms that are involved in processing nitrogen. You've got fungus, you've got animals, you've got plants, you've got microorganisms, you've got bacteria, and they're all involved in swapping nitrogen around and putting it in different chemical states so that it can be used for different types of reactions. I do remember some of this from my studies back in school. Is this essentially part of what you're talking about here?
Yes, that's precisely what I'm talking about. I mean, you've got nitrogen in the atmosphere, and nitrogen exists as two atoms stuck together with three covalent bonds. It's very, very hard to split it into individual nitrogen atoms. And yet there are organisms that are capable of doing that. They have to get that energy from somewhere. That energy ultimately comes from photosynthesis. And usually it's done by some sort of cooperative relationship between plants. Legumes are the most famous example of it. They have these nodules on their roots. And within the nodules, they have a very specific set of circumstances set up. So they have something that resembles hemoglobin, for example, in those nodules that soaks up all the oxygen. So that the bacteria that live in there are capable then of doing this amazing reaction where they take atmospheric nitrogen and essentially turn it into ammonia. And that ammonia then gets ultimately stuck onto an organic molecule. And there you've got the start, at least, of an amino acid.
Fascinating. Well, Dr. Stanish, appreciate your time today and the work you do. Again, you can hear more from Dr. Tim Stanish, who's featured as one of the scientists in the film Living Waters, Intelligent Design of the Oceans and the Earth, talking about design of the salmon olfactory sensory system, as well as a variety of other topics. Of course, Living Waters is a new film from Illustra Media. You can check it out on the internet, and it's a great way to learn about intelligent design. So, Dr. Stanish, thank you for your time today and for talking to us about your take on this topic.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm Casey Luskin with ID of the Future. Stay tuned for more, and thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID of the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.